Allah to feed him from the food of paradise and serve him from the drink of paradise. Dear friends, fasting is truly a divine act, and an act which doesn't just need to be done during the holy month of Ramadan, but rather can be done at any point. And the value of fasting is so great that in some of the traditions, Allah the Almighty says, "I am the reward for he who fasts." And so, a profound lesson brought to us by the Commander of the Faithful, telling us how fasting is truly a divine act, and fasting truly deserves a divine reward. Brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of our faith. And all physically fit and mature Muslims are required to fast every day of this month of Ramadan. Fasting is not unique to Islam. It is there in Christianity, in Judaism, even in Hindu and Buddhist tradition. There is this tradition of fasting. However, in Islam, when we talk about fasting, it is more involved in a sense that every day of the month of Ramadan, we have to abstain from dawn to dusk, abstaining from food, even from drinking water. And those who are smokers are not allowed to smoke. You know, so you'll see at the time of iftar, many people go for food, others will go outside. You know, but it's not that we encourage smoking, but that is also one of the abstinence that they have to observe. And especially keeping in mind that, you know, we do this for 29 or 30 days of the month of Ramadan. And since the Islamic months, the Islamic calendar is 10 days shorter than the common calendar. And so it does not always occur on the same, you know, time frame as the common calendar. It is always 10 days ahead. And it takes about 30 years for the month of Ramadan to go through the cycle of the seasons. And so we get this question many times. Why do the Muslims fast? There are different ways of answering that. It is actually nothing to do with the issue of atonement for the sins. This is actually considered to be an act of worship in Islam, to fast during the month of Ramadan. And the reason are multiple, actually. It has to do with physical benefits, spiritual benefits, as well as social benefits. When it comes to the physical level, you know, one thing is sure. If you fast for 29 or 30 days of the month, at the end of the month, you are going to lose a few pounds, provided you are careful with your iftar and the pre-dawn meal. Because if you overeat at that time, then, you know, it doesn't really help in that way. But we know that fasting itself has physical benefits. There was a report published from the scientist of the University of South California where it was interesting to see that they are writing, fasting for 3 days can regenerate the entire immune system, even among the elderly. And so then definitely when we do the fasting on a physical level also, there is benefit for us.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warn that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, the Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they urge both the Afghan government and the Taliban to set aside their differences and use the Afghan peace process as a great opportunity to put an end to the decades-long misery of the war-weary nation.
Unfortunately, we have gained nothing from peace summits over the past 2 years. Instead, war in the country has intensified. I think it is high time that both sides forgot about military options, set aside their differences, and launched meaningful negotiations to end the war here.
Top Afghan security officials say they stand ready to safeguard the nation in case the Taliban continue to insist on saying no to negotiations.
According to the head of Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security, the Taliban is now weaker than ever due to alleged rifts between the militant group's main leadership in Quetta Shura and its offshoot in Pakistan's Peshawar. This is thought to be a major stumbling block if the militants seek to put up a fight against some 300,000 Afghan security and defense forces after the withdrawal of nearly 10,000 foreign troops from Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has seen a surge in coronavirus cases in times with the rest of the country. The pandemic was almost brought under control in February in the region, but within weeks, the numbers have swollen again to around 18,000 positive cases. Healthcare experts equally blame Kashmir's administration and locals for the spike. Despite the risks, the administration in Kashmir allowed and organized spring festivals. They were attended by thousands without following precautions, leading to a resurge in coronavirus cases. And to worsen things, tourists' inflow to Kashmir went unchecked. Kashmir has hardly witnessed normalcy since August 2019, when India unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomous status. Now, amid the second wave of the pandemic, fresh tensions are expected as new lockdowns would collapse the region's economy. Farooq Ahmed Shah, a hotelier, is discussing the ongoing situation with his staff. He's worried, but not for himself.
We have witnessed back-to-back lockdowns. Unfortunately, we do hiring every year, but with no time, we have to lay off. I'm not much worried about my business. But for these young men who have no source of daily income or savings that can sustain them in tough times, Kashmir's economy has always been suffering. But since 2019, Kashmir is witnessing horrible times and people are forced into poverty.
Kashmir's economy is dependent on tourism and agriculture. This year, the region witnessed year-long bookings in advance. However, the new wave of the pandemic in India has triggered panic and cancellations.
The pandemic since 2020 has 100% affected us, but you know, from November, the tourism started reviving, and December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed, if not 100, but 80% for sure. So since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kick-started the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trials that you have to go for more, you know, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 million doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V. Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure. Last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met, while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment. And that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation, anything that we can do to fix the foundational level. Sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Mujahideen Brigades held a military drill to show its readiness in fight against Israeli forces. The drill, named Effective Promise, was held in several parts of the enclave, simulating many defensive combat scenarios on the ground and sea. The drill also sent a clear message to the Zionist regime that the resistance will fight back the crimes committed against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds in light of the recent clashes in the Holy City.
This drill serves as a clear message to Israel that the resistance front is ready to face any aggression. This is also a message of support to our sons in Jerusalem al-Quds, who are fighting the Zionists with all their strength.
Attending the establishment anniversary of Mujahideen Brigades, leaders of Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, expressed their support to Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Jerusalem is our red line, and the Israeli regime will be held accountable for the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine, and we stand in solidarity with our sons in Jerusalem and will fight alongside them at all costs.
We are all united in the face of the Israeli regime. This is a national battle, and we are all united in protecting Jerusalem al-Quds against the Zionists. The battle is not only in Jerusalem. It's underway in every part of Palestine, and we are ready to sacrifice our lives for Palestine.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured in clashes at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting "Death to Arabs" in their rally in the center of the occupied city.
The resistance here showed it won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes committed against the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem al-Quds, vowing to defend the Palestinian rights at all costs. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Israel has admitted its missile system tried but failed to intercept a Syrian missile that landed near the regime's top secret and most sensitive Dimona military nuclear site. Tel Aviv claimed the missile had landed in the Israeli-occupied territories as a result of Iran's Syrian anti-aircraft fire. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz said the incident was under investigation. Experts, however, say the path of the projectile flew triggered the speculation that Dimona had been the target. They added that Israel insisted to keep the incident mysterious and it had imposed its own narrative on the media.
Israel tried to keep the incident mysterious. It imposed a specific story on the media that it was a surface-to-air missile and not surface-to-surface missile in an attempt, maybe, to hide the identity of who's behind the attack. Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile shield has failed to intercept and down the missile.
The Israeli military said that in response to the launch, it attacked several missile batteries in Syria, including the one that fired the projectile that struck its territory. Syria's state news agency said Syrian air defense intercepted the Israeli attack that targeted areas in the Damascus suburbs. Israeli officials were angered by what happened. Avigdor Lieberman, former Minister of Military Affairs and the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's rival, said the regime had no functioning government and the power of the deterrence is spent.
The missile fire was kind of a surprise even on the political level. We read Israeli official statements. They were trading excuses. Like Lieberman and others, the message was strong and clear and it has affected Israel's strategic security image. It was an incident that was seen as a response to the various confrontations between Iran and Israel. Israel is not in its best situation. Israel feels threatened.
The incident happened only weeks after Israel said it had upgraded Iron Dome in a latest step in Mideast arms race. These upgrades included the ability to knock out threats at higher and lower altitudes and to strike longer numbers of incoming rockets could be fired mainly from Lebanon, Syria, and the besieged Gaza Strip.
Tel Aviv has always praised its own Iron Dome missile defense system in repelling attacks, but this time it failed to intercept the Syrian-fired missile, which Israel said landed near its nuclear site, underscoring Tel Aviv's military fragility. Mona Kandil, occupied Albire.
Pakistan has called out army to help police and other paramilitary personnel to enforce strict precautionary measures in bazaars and streets to contain what the government says a sudden surge in COVID-19 cases.
Agar humne ab ehtiyat na ki.
Prime Minister Imran Khan in a televised address warned the nation that his country may soon be facing a grim situation similar to that of India, where on an average 2,000 people die every day and more than 300,000 test positive.
I have appealed to the people time and again to follow precautionary measures. However, neither people are scared of coronavirus, nor they are adopting any precautionary measures. And that is why now there is surge in coronavirus cases.
Under a new decision, Pakistan has shut down schools in regions with a surge in COVID-19 cases. All markets would be closed by 6 p.m., indoor and outdoor dining have also been banned. Only 50% staff would be allowed to work in private and government offices, while offices would be closed at 2 p.m. On an average, 100 to 150 people die daily, while between 5,000 to 6,000 people test positive every day in 220 million populated country. So far, there are as many as 102,000 total active cases in Pakistan, while nearly 16,900 people have died since March last year. The government has warned the people to get ready to face complete lockdown of major urban centers if they do not put up masks on their faces to contain the virus.
People would die with hunger if government shuts down the cities. There would be shortage of food items like sugar, flour, and oil. What would we do then?
A survey conducted by Gallup Pakistan last month reported that 65% people believe that the government is exaggerating the threat of the COVID-19.
A significant number of people suffer from allergic-linked diseases such as flu, cough,
fever and asthma, and many of them die every spring weather in parts of Pakistan. However, since March last year, the medical nomenclature in Pakistan have changed, and now most of these diseases have been officially classified as COVID-19 cases under what is medically known as PCR testing system, which many medical experts believe are churning out false positive cases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Despite the lockdown and curfew, thousands took the streets in Paris to protest against the reform of the social security system. The main reform concerns unemployed people who will receive less unemployment benefits. They will suffer an average loss of 20%, and some will even lose 45% of their unemployment compensation, meaning 300 euros less by month. Many will not be able to pay their rent. The demonstrators blame the French government for taking advantage of the COVID crisis to accelerate anti-popular measures.
Those who will be sanctioned by this reform are those who already suffer the most from the decrease in the work volume due to the COVID crisis. All the vulnerable workers who already lost their job and who are not financially supported by the government will become unemployed and will be affected by this reform. Yes, the government takes advantage of the crisis and pushes for unjust reforms.
Cultural workers made the demonstration very lively. They are paying a heavy price due to the outbreak of the COVID-19.
Today, people who work in the cultural sector often return to their parents and have no income anymore. Since more than 1 year, we don't work, we don't earn money, and the government does not propose any solution to us. Culture is part of the freedom of expression. Only the big shows financed by the state will survive, and the others will disappear.
Billions are given to big companies, 500 billion euros. At the same time, these companies fire workers. How is it possible that this government is making the shareholders richer instead of helping the population?
Indeed, the French stock exchange market has reached a very high level with more than 6,000 points. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well since the COVID crisis, but the majority of the population does not benefit from this. More than 100 symbolic cultural places like the Odeon Theater are occupied since weeks, with protesters vowing to continue demonstrations until their demands are met.
The COVID crisis will inevitably lead to loss of jobs for many workers. Also, if unemployment benefits are affected, these workers will be punished twice. Chris Denant, Paris.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. I welcome you to the program Month of Allah. Brothers and sisters, I recommend that you during the month of Ramadan for sure read this sermon in the speech that the Holy Prophet of Islam gave for the month of Ramadan. You can find it, it has been translated. And in this speech, he talks about what one should do if he wants to cross the Sirat, cross the narrow bridge, and doesn't want his feet to shake. What should he do? And the Prophet of Islam says, "Man hassana minkum fi hadha ash-shahr khuluqa," if he makes beautiful his acts, his akhlaq, his behavior, then he will be of those that will pass very easily the Sirat, the narrow bridge, and he will enter heaven. Because fasting is something that is difficult, being away from food might make us agitated. Therefore, sometimes we might take this on our family members, this deprivation of food, and we might yell at them, we might act in a ill manner towards them. And this is what we want to talk about today, is that how should we behave towards our family members while we're fasting? Because our family members are the ones that see how we truly behave. Sometimes we're very good Muslims when we enter the masjid, Salamun alaykum, Sabahkum Allah. But we enter home, World War III starts. We shouldn't be like that. I remember my teacher, Ayatollah Mujtahidi, he would always say, it is not important how many people pray behind you. It is important when your wife decides to pray behind you that she sees you as a just person. Brothers and sisters, we are either married right now or we're thinking about marriage. In the month of Ramadan, we have to increase and be more careful of our acts towards our spouses. When we look at the traditions and we look at what we want to learn from the teachings of the Prophet and his family, we see that if we want to have a successful family, if we want to behave in a correct way, there are three things that we need to do. The first thing is we need to respect each other in the month of Ramadan. مَنْ اتَّخَذَ إِمْرَأَةً فَلْيُكْرِمْهَا. And whoever takes a wife, whoever gets a spouse, they should honor them. They should not talk to them in a very bad way. They should always, in front of their kids, bring up their status. And this especially goes to mothers that talk to the children of their father, to their husbands. When they talk to them, make sure that when you talk to the father, you always bring him up. Because children need that sense of a father figure. If you crush that father figure, the children will not be able to follow the instructions of their father anymore. At the same time, we need to, men and husbands need to show love and compassion and honor to their wives. If you crush that mother feeling, if you don't show love to her, that child will not be able to receive love in that family, will not appreciate the status of the woman, will not learn how to treat his own wife. So the first thing we need to do in the month of Ramadan is to be able to honor each other. The second thing is we need to learn to forgive each other. There is a beautiful saying from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, Imam Ali ibn Hussein, and Jahid, a prose writer. He put this in a beautiful statement that he says, if you want everything good in this world, it is summed up in a jar. If you want everything good in the world, this jar is what? 2/3 of this jar, because he learned from Ali ibn Hussein, 2/3 of this jar is fitna. Fitna with a ta, not with a te. Fitna with a ta means to be clever. If you want to live life, you want to have a good life, be clever, be smart, don't be naive. But on the other hand, we need, he says, the other 1/3. And what is the other 1/3? Taghafun, meaning to forget, make yourself in a way that I'm going to be neglectful. When you see something from your spouse, you're just going to pretend as if it never ever happened. When you see something from your kids sometimes, you pretend, you show yourself as a more very charismatic and very important person. If you see something, an act, a small act, you should show yourself as the better person. You should show yourself as that person that forgives, that person that has taghaful and doesn't even pay attention to the dishonoring statements of the spouse. The last thing that we want to talk about is not finding faults in each other. In general, we should not look at each other's faults and defects as a lord. We are not a lord, we're humble servants. We should look at our own faults and examine our own faults as if a lord is looking at his own servants. How does a lord look at his own servants? He says, what time were you here? Why were you late? Why did you do that? When it comes to ourselves, we question ourselves. But when it comes to each other, we don't have such a view upon each other. We don't find faults with each other. So we have these three things that inshallah in this month of Ramadan, we can give respect and honor to each other, we can forgive each other, and lastly, we can stop finding faults with one another, and inshallah we can have that akhlaq and ethics that the Messenger of Allah said, whoever has will pass the Sirat, the narrow bridge, and will enter heaven easily, inshallah.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله من سعى في حاجة أخيه المؤمن فكأنما عبد الله 9,000 سنة صائما نهاره قائما ليله.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله said, he who strives to grant the needs of his brother in faith is like he has worshipped Allah for 9,000 years, fasting his days and praying his nights.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Austin's personal history and connection to the military and rating mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., says Jeremy Kuzmarov, writer, in an article titled, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has awarded over $2.36 billion in contracts to Raytheon since his confirmation in January. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. March 23rd was another good day for Raytheon with a receipt of 63,301,453 contract for repair of an APG G573 all-weather sensor radar system, which is operational in the U.S. Navy's F-18 fighter jets, and another $10,246,288 contract for repair of military jet engines. The company had yet more cause for celebration on March 30th. When Raytheon's Tucson, Arizona branch received a $130 million contract for upgrades to the Rolling Airframe Missile Block 2 to a guided missile round pack, which is designed to protect U.S. Navy ships from incoming missiles. The next day, two separate contracts amounting to $138 million, one for more F-35 maintenance work and another for the production of mine-hunting sonars. Though Austin claims to have recused himself from decisions involving Raytheon, the Pentagon under his direction is providing his old company with huge contracts on a daily basis that is bolstering its profits and stock price. Austin furthermore has used his new bully pulpit to advance for yet greater levels of military spending to the benefit of Raytheon. On February 25th, for example, on a visit to the USS Nimitz, Austin emphasized the need for U.S. warships throughout the globe to deter security threats. A week later, on a tour of Southeast Asia with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Austin warned about China again and North Korean nuclear threat and pledged that the U.S. would maintain a robust military presence in the Indo-Pacific. He further cautioned North Korea that the U.S., following military exercises with South Korea, was ready to fight tonight. When fighting resumed in eastern Ukraine in early April, Austin assured Ukraine's defense minister, Andriy Taran, of the U.S. commitment to building the capacity of Ukraine's forces to defend more effectively against Russia, which was demonstrated by a recent $125 million military aid package, and took to Twitter to reaffirm the U.S. unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and Euro-Atlantic aspirations. The latter implied the joining of the European Union and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which would inevitably escalate conflict between the world's two major nuclear armed powers, the U.S. and Russia. On April 13th, Austin announced that the U.S. would increase its military presence in Germany by about 500 personnel and was scuttling plans to introduce by President Donald Trump for a large troop reduction in Europe. Austin, meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, affirmed the U.S.-Israeli regime relationship, which receives a record $3.8 billion in U.S. military aid each year, and on a visit to Afghanistan stated that the Biden administration wanted to see a responsible end to the Afghan war, but that the level of violence must decrease for fruitful diplomacy to have a chance. These comments and many others were music to the ears of Raytheon, which gave $506,424 in donations to Biden's presidential campaign. Besides his connection to Raytheon, Austin's appointment as Pentagon chief was controversial because he had not been retired from the military for the requisite 7 years and required a legal waiver. Traditionally, the role of defense secretary is supposed to be a civilian position, ensuring the U.S. military apparatus is led not by a war fighter, but a policymaker. That requirement is laid out in the National Security Act of 1947 that established the Defense Department. Heralded as a soldier who would endure hardships with his troops, Austin graduated from West Point in 1975 and led infantry troops in the capture of Baghdad during the 2003 Operation Iraqi Freedom. After a stint commanding the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan, Austin was appointed as Chief of Staff of U.S. Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, a high-tech command post where military officers could watch live imagery on plasma screens and order airstrikes through the Pentagon's secure internet server. Groomed for high military command by Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2007 to 2011, Austin was appointed as Commanding General of U.S. Forces in Iraq in 2010 and Commander of U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, which is responsible for military operations in the West Asia North Africa region by President Obama in 2013. In this latter capacity, Austin drafted a war plan approved by Obama that allowed the U.S. military for the first time to directly provide ammunition and weapons to Syrian opposition forces, who included terrorists. President Obama also endorsed General Austin's idea to increase the air campaign on Daesh from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The result was an increase in civilian deaths. Journalists Anand Gopal and Azmat Khat determined that 1 in 5 of 27,500 coalition airstrikes in the second Iraq war resulted in at least one civilian death, more than 31 times the number that was publicly acknowledged. Austin's personal history and connection to the military and Raytheon mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., when civilians no longer control the key institutions of government and war industries ensure the perpetuation of endless wars from which they make obscene profits, the political system can no longer be defined as a democracy.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an...
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of...
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
پیغمبر فرمود تو همون خطبه شبانیش فرمود که ایها الناس ان انفسکم مرهونتون به اعمالکم.
Prophet Muhammad in his Shabaniya sermon said, O people, your soul is the captive of your deeds. This sentence of the Prophet is very important. Many of us cannot promote because our souls are the captive of our deeds. In fact, we are the captive of our desires, of our deeds, and our tongue. Yes, some people are the captive of their tongues. Some people tell lies. We must practice to control our tongue.
گاهی موقع آدم اسیر چشم میشه میدونه این چشم داره میبرتش جهنم.
Sometimes we are the captive of our eyes. We know that our eyes are leading us toward hellfire, but we still commit sins with it. Sometimes we are the captive of our attributes. We have greed and hatred in our hearts. When we are suspicious about everything, we are the captive of our desires. Being the captive of our deeds is like being a nightingale caught in the claws of an eagle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.